Welcome to Creating Sanctuary, a global interview series featuring 21 heroes who are saving animals' lives. I'm your host, Yolanda Calderon, and the hero I'm interviewing today is Suzanne Roy. Suzanne is a 25-year animal welfare professional. During her career, she's worked to improve the plight of elephants, chimpanzees, marine mammals, and other animals both in captivity and in the wild. In 2009, she turned her attention to the fight to save America's wild horses and burros. She currently lives in Davis, California, with her family, which includes an amazing horse named Cobalt. Welcome, Suzanne. I am so happy you could join us.
Thank you, Yolanda. Thank you for having me.
It just came to my attention that it would be really important to include you in this discussion because we are talking about wild horses in some other interviews and burros in some other interviews, but I like your approach because I think you can explain to us more clearly why America's wild horses and burros actually do need saving. So that's my first question to you.
Okay. Well, it's a complicated area, but I'll try to make it as straightforward and simple as possible. America's wild horses and burros are protected under federal law, and it's a law that was passed in 1971, the Wild Free Roaming Horses and Burros Act, and it declares the horses to be living symbols of the historic and pioneer spirit of the American West, and they are to be protected from branding, harassment, capture, and death. Now, that law was passed unanimously by Congress in 1971. At the time, the Congress received more mail about protecting wild horses and burros than it did on any other subject besides the Vietnam War. So it was a big issue. The horses and burros enjoyed very broad public support. When the law was passed, their numbers had dwindled to about 25,000, from 2 million horses and burros at the turn of the century to 25,000 in 1971. Wow. And the reason they disappeared is that ranchers, known as Mustangers, would go out regularly and capture horses through a variety of brutal methods, or even just kill horses by poisoning them and driving them over cliffs. I mean, there's a whole horrible history of brutality that was committed against Mustangs by ranchers who wanted to get rid of them so that the land would be fully available to graze their cattle. And so they had rounded up so many horses and shipped them to slaughter plants where they became dog food, where the Mustangs were turned into dog food, that by 1971 there were only 25,000 left. Yeah. And Congress determined they were fast disappearing and in need of protection. So that was the law that was passed. It was passed to protect wild horses and burros on lands managed by the Bureau of Land Management and the U.S. Forest Service in 10 western states. And so fast forward to today, what happened was the Congress put the Bureau of Land Management in charge of managing the horses, and essentially the BLM, as it's known, took over where the ranchers left off. So now instead of private ranchers rounding up the horses to make the land available for their cattle, the government was doing it for them, and the government rounds up horses by helicopters. They do what's called helicopter roundups, where they send helicopters out into these remote areas of the West where wild horses live. They flush them out of the mountains and the trees and down into the valleys and stampede them into traps. And these roundups are very traumatic, obviously, and terrifying for the horses. And many horses are injured or killed in the roundups themselves or in the months after, as the horses are thrown into holding pens. And many die of injuries or just failure to thrive. They just stop eating and starve to death, or other kind of ailments like colic and things like that. So these roundups are very brutal. The BLM rounds up thousands of horses every year from our public lands, and because the number of horses that they're removing far exceeds the adoption demand, there's a surplus of horses, captured horses, which the government puts into holding pens. So these horses that were out there on our public lands earning their own keep are now in holding pens, and the taxpayer is paying anywhere from $2 to $5 a day per horse to feed and house them. And the whole system is set up. It's just another aspect of the federal entitlement program for ranchers. I mean, you've probably heard of the term welfare rancher. And that's a small number of American ranchers have permits to graze their livestock on our public land. And they do so at greatly reduced grazing fees. So the government charges a rancher $1.45 per animal per month to graze on the public lands. The equivalent grazing fee for private lands in the West is an average of $20 per animal per month. So you can see it's a huge discount, and it's a majorly taxpayer-subsidized program. So the ranchers continue to view the Mustangs as competition for this cheap forage that's available on public lands. So they push for their removal. And in pre-1971, pre-law, the ranchers rounded up the horses themselves. After 1971, the BLM just started doing it for them. And so that brings us to the situation we have today, where the BLM is stockpiling 45,000 wild horses and burros in government holding facilities and is lobbying the Congress is asking the Congress to give the agency permission to kill those horses in holding and also to kill the excess, so-called excess horses on the range. And so right now, about 90,000 horses are in danger. And if Congress were to lift the current prohibitions on killing them and selling them for slaughter. I don't know if that was too confusing. It's a very complicated issue. So
No, you made it very clear that these are our public lands. The taxpayer is basically paying to subsidize the ranchers grazing their cattle on the public lands and clearing off the wild animals that have roamed there for over 500 years. You simplified it. Because it seems to be a confusing topic at first, because some of what you hear is that these horses are overpopulated, they are breeding like crazy, and they're non-native, so that they're ruining our natural habitat. But actually what's happening is the ranchers are grazing their cattle there, and they're not native either. So
there's a couple of important points in there, what you just said. The first one is the status of the horse is native or non-native. And the opponents of the horses all like to refer to them as feral horses, non-native, invasive, destroying the range. But the reality is the horse is a native North American wildlife species. The horse as a species evolved in North America. And it, over time, you know, over the periods of ice ages and then warming, the horses would go back and forth across the Bering Land Bridge to Asia. You know, when the bridge was exposed, when the sea level was down, the horses would travel over there. They'd come back. And then about 7,000 years ago, they went locally extinct here in North America. But they had crossed the land bridge and into Asia. And then through Asia, you know, going through Asia, they spread into Europe. They were domesticated, and then they were brought back here by the Spanish in the 1500s. And so that's the horse that the Spanish brought back is the same lineage of horse that evolved here in North America. So when you talk to an evolutionary biologist, they will tell you that the horse is a native, reintroduced North American wildlife species. And the fact that they were reintroduced from domestic stock is irrelevant biologically to their status as native. And they say it's no different than the panther that went locally extinct here, traveled to South America, thrived, and came back on its own. It's the same, it's the same thing. So that label of invasive and feral is slapped on the horses by people who are lobbying to you know, get them off. And then there's also environmentalists who are not up to date on the most modern science and continue to maintain that perspective. But scientifically, that is wrong. The horse is a native, reintroduced North American wildlife species. So there's that. And then there's the issue of overpopulation.
Mm-hmm.
So the BLM bases all of its claims of overpopulation on the so-called appropriate management level it's set for the horses. Appropriate management level is essentially the population limit that the BLM has set. And it's based on the fact that they allocate 80% of the forage in wild horse habitat areas to privately owned livestock. And then the horses get 20% of the forage, and then based on that small amount of forage allocation, the BLM sets a population limit. And the numbers are ridiculously low. For example, there are 14 million acres of BLM land in New Mexico, and the number of wild horses the BLM considers to be appropriate in New Mexico is 86. And anything over 86 horses in that state is considered overpopulation by the BLM. And their national appropriate management level is under 27,000 horses on 27 million acres of land. And remember when I said in 1971 there were 25,000 horses left,
mm-hmm.
and the Congress
yeah.
determined they were fast disappearing? Well, the BLM's population limits basically freeze the population at the fast disappearing level. And then they say anything over that is overpopulation. It's ridiculous.
Okay.
There's probably 70,000. Yeah.
They're using the 25,000 number as the baseline. And so anything above that, they're calling overpopulation.
Right, right. That's right.
Wow.
But, by comparison, there are 70,000 bighorn sheep left in the West, and they're considered endangered. But 70,000 wild horses on BLM land, the BLM is trying to tell us is overpopulated. And so that
right.
is a myth that's being propagated by the BLM.
Mm-hmm.
as it presses for more roundups and slaughter of these animals that really are cherished by the public. I mean, we've done
Absolutely.
Polling. We've done polling that shows that 80% of Americans oppose killing and slaughtering wild horses and want them protected and humanely managed on our public lands. And in Nevada, where half of the horses reside, 86% of Nevadans believe that the horses are important symbols for their state and that they should be protected and humanely managed, not slaughtered. So there's huge public support, but the BLM's policy toward wild horses doesn't reflect public will. It reflects the interests of the livestock lobby.
Because they yeah. are a powerful lobby.
That's right.
Well, you are also a powerful force in there. I have to say, I've been on your mailing list for over a year, and I've seen how effective you are with your campaigns. So before beginning your work with animal welfare, you were a political consultant, and you worked on all kinds of different campaigns. So first of all, what inspired you to make the shift to work for the animals?
Well, I've always just been an animal person. You know, growing up, I love animals. I became a vegetarian on my own at age 19. I didn't even know another vegetarian. I grew up in sort of a small town in Pennsylvania that was where I grew up, was sort of on the border of a rural area, and there was a farm close by, and I saw a cow being taken away to slaughter, and then like a couple of days later, I saw them like grinding meat in their front yard, and I was said
mm-hmm.
that, you know, I would never eat meat again. But even before that, I just couldn't eat any sort of thing that resembled an animal, you know, chicken bones or anything like that. I don't know. It's just
right.
innate in me. And then, so after I worked on these political campaigns, I worked for Gary Hart in 1987 and 88 when he was his presidential campaign, when he had to withdraw after being caught with another woman, and it was a whole big it was a big trauma to go through, to have the national media descend on us. And anyway, it was a lot of turmoil and upheaval. And after that sort of election cycle, I decided I wanted to work on something a little more stable, and I went to Washington to find a job to help animals or children. Children or animals were the two things that really were important to me. And then I found a job. I worked for the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine in Washington, D.C. And then I learned about all the range of animal rights issues that I hadn't even been aware of previously.
That so many of us are not aware of still. I mean, I'm just by doing this interview series, I'm learning so many different issues on so many different fronts.
I bet.
Yeah, back to your Gary Hart comment, contrast that to what's happening today. It's crazy, huh?
Oh, my gosh. How far we've evolved. Yes,
no
really
kidding.
Something. Regardless of the scandal, Gary Hart was very, I have a lot of admiration and respect for him. Our supporter base is very bipartisan. We are very bipartisan. We do not take positions. Of course, we are fighting the administration's plans for the horses, but politically we're not, you know, we don't take positions politically because we have to represent our base, and our base is divided, like the country. Yeah.
Right.
I think it's true that all animal issues have very bipartisan support because I was told by a lobbyist in California that the Republican caucus did polling that found animal issues like in the top five in Republican districts that people were concerned with, and it was like in the top two or three in the swing districts. So support for animal welfare is bipartisan. Amongst the people, now I would say the legislators are by far more Democrats support animal welfare measures than Republicans. But amongst the people, it's very bipartisan.
Okay. If someone's listening to this and they're learning for the first time what the actual issue is, what can people do now, right now, to start helping the wild horses in burros?
Well, the main thing that people can do is contact their congressperson and their senators. Because we're now engaged in the 2019 appropriations fight. And once again, the BLM is requesting permission to kill the horses. So we need everyone to contact their congresspersons and their senators and tell them that the BLM should manage these horses humanely and in accordance with scientific recommendations and not be allowed to kill or slaughter them. And besides calling, one thing people can do is set up meetings in the district offices. You can call your congressman and say, hey, I want to come in and talk about this issue, and they will set you up with a staff person. People can contact us for talking points and materials that they can bring to those meetings. And really the best lobbyist for wild horses or any animal issue is the constituent of the official that you're trying to influence. So it's actually a very powerful tool, not just to call, but actually to take that step and make an appointment, go in there, even bring some of your friends or family, or bring a letter signed by your neighbors saying, I'm representing this many people and I'm asking you to maintain protections for wild horses and burros. That's the most important thing people can do. And also they can join our mailing list if they go to our website, AmericanWildHorseCampaign.org. Right on the front, you can join our email list, and we pretty much weekly put out updates and actions that people can take to help wild horses. So that's another way to stay involved.
Agreed. You've affected me and what I've done. I mean, I'm in Oakland, California, so my congressperson is totally on board. So,
yes, right.
You've had an impact on what I feel I can do. And you put a video together. You had a mashup of a bunch of different people talking on a video and talking about the wild horse slaughter and how we can use birth control. There are humane methods of managing these populations. And you added me to that video. I was so excited.
Oh, that's right. Yes. Thank you for doing that. That's great.
My pleasure.
Well, it made a difference. I want to tell you because the 2018 omnibus spending bill was just passed like 2 weeks ago, and it did maintain the protections for wild horses and burros. And, you know, over the strong lobbying of the big ag industry, They were pushing hard for horse slaughter, and the bill that came out maintained prohibitions on killing and selling wild horses and burros for slaughter, and it also maintained the prohibition on federal funding for USDA inspections of horse slaughter plants. And
right.
That is a de facto ban on horse slaughter in the U.S. because without inspections, these plants can't produce horse meat for human consumption. So it
mm-hmm.
keeps the horse slaughter plants closed. So we had a slaughter-free bill, and that is thanks to efforts, your efforts and others who participated in all the different ways to express your opinion to Congress over the last year.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, yeah, I've been really impressed with your communication and your actionable items. So with all of the bad news that's happening with the horses and burros right now, how
mm-hmm.
do you guys stay so inspired and how do you stay in a powerful place? Because I know that when I first learned about this stuff, I felt completely deflated.
Yeah, I think that the antidote to that is just, you know, having these small and not so small victories, right? So the 2018
mm-hmm.
omnibus bill that maintained protections for horses and burros was huge. That's a big win. And the reason it happened is the power of our grassroots. So, you know, recognizing that power is important. And then, you know, we've got victories on the legal front and in different areas. So I think that's one way is, you know, celebrating your victories. And understanding that ultimately the power of the people can and must prevail, right? And that we have the power of the people on our side.
One of my other questions is, so all of these horses that are in holding pens right now, some of them do go to sanctuaries, right? Are there any sanctuaries that you like to support or that you can tell us about where these horses might go?
Well, yeah, there are some great sanctuaries. You know, none of them have the volume, the capacity to take in as many horses as there are in holding. But there are a couple of sanctuaries in Colorado. One is called Angler Canyon Ranch, run by the Serengeti Foundation. And they just took, over 100, maybe 200 horses out of holding. And they took the ones that were there the longest, you know, the saddest cases. And now they're running free on this beautiful, huge ranch in Colorado. And then there's another sanctuary in Colorado called the Great Escape Mustang Sanctuary, and
mm-hmm.
they work with the Sandwash Basin Herd Management Area in Colorado, where there's an amazing population of wild horses. And they have a component that manages the horses with birth control, and then they have a component that takes horses that have to be removed from the range, like if the BLM says there's just too many, even with the birth control. I think last year or the year before, they removed 50 horses from the Sandwash Basin, and the Great Escape Mustang Sanctuary takes those horses and the ones that are adoptable, they will train and adopt out, and then the ones that are older and really not appropriate for training get to live on their sanctuary. So that's another great sanctuary and model. And then, you know, we have some good ones out here. Our board president, Ellie Phipps Price, she has a sanctuary in Northern California called Montgomery Creek Ranch, and that's home for about 240. Some of those horses came from holding, but most of them were rescued from slaughter auctions or failed adoptions where they were headed to slaughter auction.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a beautiful facility. And then there's a wonderful sanctuary called Freedom Range, south of San Jose, so south of Gilroy. And that's home to almost 500 horses and a lot of Mustangs that have been rescued, including a number of bands of horses that we rescued and placed there. And that's so we're very grateful for that facility, too. So those are just some of the sanctuaries, yeah.
Yeah, thank you. That's a great resource. Are you in favor of organizations taking these wild horses and getting them ready to ride or to use as pets, or do you prefer that they stay wild? What's your opinion about that?
Well, our whole focus is keeping wild horses wild and on the range. And
mm-hmm.
when they're removed and put into the adoption system, number one is
the demand can't meet, the number removed. And number two, they just, it's hard. Horses live a long time. They're expensive. When you're talking about a wild horse, you're talking about needing resources and knowledge to be able to train that horse so he or she can be comfortable in domestic life, and not everyone has that. So what happens is a lot of adoptions fail, and a lot of BLM horses do end up in the slaughter pipeline. And so our focus and our preference is to keep them free on the range. Now,
right.
For the horses that are already off the range, you know, we do support good adoption programs and placement into good homes. But for the ones that are on the range, we fight hard to keep them there because we know what happens. I'm just dealing with the situation now that we placed four horses from Nevada, the Virginia range in Nevada, through our agreement with the state. And we sent them to a small sanctuary in Alabama. And it was a couple, and the couple ended up getting divorced. And the ex-husband sent the horses to a kill buyer. And we're just in the process. We had to buy them back from the kill buyer, and we're transporting them back, and I'm going to be looking for placement. Anyway, it just shows you the perils of adoption. It's tough.
Wow. Yeah, you are dealing with a lot. So you're dealing with the big picture and drilling down into all of the detail, too, like individual horses.
Right.
That's pretty amazing.
We're busy.
Yeah, you are busy. How big is your team?
Let's see. Our team is, well, we have about 5 staff and a number of consultants that help us with our work.
Yeah. And you're in Davis, California. If someone's listening to this and they want to get involved with you, what's the best way?
I think they can visit our website, AmericanWildHorseCampaign.org, or shoot us an email, contact@AmericanWildHorseCampaign.org. That would probably be the best way. Oh, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. We're all over that.
Okay. And do you take any volunteers?
Well, yeah, we sometimes do. It just depends on the person and the area and the interest and expertise. But anyone who wants to volunteer should definitely contact us. We have everything from, you know, hands-on type stuff to office stuff that needs to be done.
Great. Is there anything you want to add?
Well, maybe I should just say that the going back to the public lands grazing issue, that, as I said in the beginning, the wild horse and burro issue is part of the whole federal entitlement program for public lands ranching, and it involves $500 million a year or more of taxpayer subsidies for the reduced grazing fees. It includes federal funding for the USDA Wildlife Services Department, which goes in and kills predators at the request of ranchers. So they kill millions of predators every year, including wolves, mountain lions,
coyotes.
Yeah. In Nevada, the USDA has 2 planes that fly full-time aerial gunning coyotes for the USDA. Yeah.
Oh,
so
my God.
So they're killing predators, and they're, you know, rounding up wild horses and burros and putting them in holding pens and sending taxpayers the bill. So it's all wrapped up in the same, you know, entitlement program. And the victims are wildlife, wild horses, burros, and taxpayers.
Okay, so how do we stop that?
Now that's a harder issue because there are many groups. There have been many groups fighting that for a long time. And it's complicated, and a lot of it goes back to homesteading and rights to graze on public lands that are attached to base properties. But one of the things I think that would solve the problem immediately is if Congress would just charge market rate for grazing on public lands. That would do it.
But
getting Congress to do that is another question, because you've got, it's kind of like going against the NRA, right? You've got the Farm Bureau, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, you know, very powerful, wealthy lobbying groups that keep that subsidy system in place. So it's a tough row to hoe, but that would do it if we just charge market rate for grazing on public land.
Yeah. In terms of animal welfare, what is giving you the most hope right now?
Well, you know, I started working on this issue in like 1988. So actually, I said 25 years. It's 30 years. I hate to say that.
Okay.
But it's changed so much. And so what I would say is there's a much greater public awareness and acceptance of the importance of animal welfare. And I'm very encouraged that, you know, these younger, sophisticated groups that have come up, like Mercy for Animals and different groups like that, I find them to be very effective and sophisticated in what they do. And I think that's very encouraging that this new generation has come up and are doing great things. And then I think the whole move toward plant-based foods and meat alternatives and all that is growing and growing, and I think that's very encouraraging. So,
yeah, me too. Suzanne Roy, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a real pleasure talking to you and super informative. You have a great way of communicating the message and making it very clear for us. And I also want to thank our listeners, and I want to encourage them to go to your website at AmericanWildHorseCampaign.org. You've been listening to Creating Sanctuary for Animals, and I'm your host, Yolanda Calderon, and I look forward to talking with you all again soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.